Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Windows Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Windows Vista with Paul Thurrott, Episode 3 for October 20th, 2006, Windows Vista's enthusiastic license agreement. Time for Windows Weekly, Episode 3, and Paul Thurrott is here to talk about the latest happenings with Vista. We picked a perfect time to start this podcast because it seems like every week there are new big stories coming out about Vista. Hello, Paul.
Hey, how are you doing?
Before we go too far, Paul, one thing I do want to bring up is the title of the last podcast was the Windows Shiv. And I think people thought we made a mistake.
Yeah.
But it was intentional.
Oh, it was intentional, yeah.
Okay, so these things are technically called shims, and I think I mentioned that. I brought that up.
You did. You used the word shim, yeah.
But shiv is not a mistake. Shim is what they call it.
I did that for some of my buddies there. I mean, you have to understand that they're, you know, Microsoft is not known as a company that makes elegant things, you know, but there are people that really care and they don't want that stuff getting into their operating system.
Right.
They hate it. So this is what they call it, the Windows
Shiv. They think of it as a knife in their operating system.
Exactly. This is just something that's destroying something beautiful, you know.
Maybe we should have made it clearer that we were using the ironic term that is used. This is used within Microsoft. It's not. But it isn't the technical term.
It's not the official.
If you read
term,
their documentation, if you ask Bill Gates,
you'll never see that.
If you ask Bill Gates, he say it's a shiv.
People claim to have never heard of it.
It's a shiv. What's that? But we were making the point at the time that it is an ugly thing to have to do to an operating system.
You know, backwards compatibility is their
nightmare.
Big deal.
Yep. So I guess the big story. First, let's just say you called it, and IE7 did come out, and did it happen the way you talked about last week, where people were given the choice and so forth?
Yeah. Well, that will be happening. So as of today, or as of the other day, I should say, Internet Explorer 7 is available to anyone who wants to go download it. And starting in about 3 weeks, I believe it is, Microsoft will start deploying it via automatic updates, and I'm told this will take 2 to 3 months before they hit everybody.
Wow.
So if you're waiting to get it that way, you might want to just go grab it.
How do they do that? They have some sort of IP address lottery?
I have no idea how they do it. Yeah, I don't know.
That's clever.
I mean, they have, you know, a gazillion users, and I guess, you know, they have to throttle the download, I guess.
But it means they must keep track of who they've sent it to. Well, I guess they know once they've sent it to you because they see it, unless you decline to install it.
Oh, they know.
They know.
You know
they
know.
They keep a manifest of some kind about what's been
right.
downloaded. Right.
Pay no attention to that single pixel in the corner of your screen.
But IE7 is now available, the final release version. And since we talked last week, I did update my site to make it IE7 compatible, so no more skip.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, well, somebody sent me some code, which was great.
And do you have any idea how hard it was to change it?
It was very easy. It was a few lines.
Yeah.
The one line at the top basically says, if you're IE7, then load this CSS file. And it's a small one-line CSS file. And so, it's ugly in the sense that you have to check for IE7 and then say... you put in a comment, in an HTML comment, and you say, if IE7, then load this CSS. And the CSS really just has its own div tag for the width of the comment box. So it's a very simple thing to implement, I guess. Not one of those crazy CSS hacks, anyway.
Yeah, the version checking stuff in websites is awful. You know, I don't like to do that.
But. Yeah, but it's just a way of life, unfortunately, especially if you use JavaScript or CSS. The other big story, and it's a huge story, we talked a little bit about it on Twit, but I'd love to know what you think. And I'd also love to know what the latest is, because it seems to be a shifting story, is this the licensing on Windows Vista. The Windows Vista blog had some information. Have they released the actual EULAs? Or?
Yes, they have released a Windows Vista EULA.
Have you looked at the EULA?
I have.
It sounds like a song. Look for EULA. The Windows EULA.
EULA is a name like Esther that people used to have back in the 1950s. You know,
if you were named EULA, you had to be flat fat. That was just part of the job.
Right.
So it stands for End User License Agreement. It's what we'll all agree to. They're shrink wrap EULAs. So as soon as you open the box or click the button, you've agreed to it. What are we agreeing to?
Well, that's a good question. And more important, perhaps, why is it that we can't agree to it until we're installing the application, you know, or the operating system in this case? As you know, we were discussing earlier, one of the things that really amazes me in this day and age is that you're not presented with the rights you have to this product until you're installing it. And granted, Microsoft does make it available via their website and so forth, but I think we all understand that once you open a software product, and if you actually read the EULA and say, you know, actually, I don't agree with that, you know, you can't really bring it back, right? You know, the product is open.
You opened it.
Yeah. So it's one of those kind of weird
it's like a catch
legal
22,
issues, I guess.
Yeah. But they, you know, I actually asked Denise Howell, who hosts our This Week in Law podcast, and she said that these click-through EULAs or click-through agreements and shrink-wrap EULAs have been, as I understand it, upheld in court. So they're legal.
Right.
I think there's still some question about shrink-wrap EULAs, but so far, they're legal. So
yeah, and I don't know. There were some circumstances a few years ago where a group of Linux enthusiasts were trying to get, you know, Toshiba to take back their copy of Windows and pay them back. Because they were never going to use Windows, remember?
Right. I remember that.
And, that didn't really go too well, I guess.
No. In fact, there was people went and protested at Microsoft and brought their Windows.
Oh, yeah. Storming Windows. The gates. just like in Frankenstein.
We want our money back. Give us the monster.
Exactly.
So one of the things that the license agreement says you agree to is, and this is, I think, the most controversial one so far, is you can only transfer, you can only upgrade once and you can only transfer it once.
That's right.
What does that mean exactly?
Okay. So, and again, I just want to preface this by I am not a legal expert. And, you know, I read this and it's gobbledygook to me, but my understanding, or actually we can quote from parts of it. So let's sort of examine how the language has changed.
Let the audience decide.
Exactly. And we should also be clear that this is the retail version of Windows XP that we're talking about, Windows or any version of Windows, XP and Vista here. So if you acquire Windows.
Oh, this changed XP as well?
No, it didn't.
No,
I'm going to compare.
Just Vista. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
I'm going to compare XP to Vista here.
I got it.
I want to make sure what we're talking about is the retail version.
Retail. So. All right.
If you buy a copy of, you buy a PC and you get a copy of Windows with it, which Microsoft tells me is over 90% of all Windows users, this doesn't apply. You can't actually transfer that copy of Windows to another machine.
At all.
And that's always been the case. That actually hasn't changed.
You can't sell it. You could sell the machine and the Windows would go with it.
Exactly.
But you couldn't in any way. Yeah, that makes sense because you bought it with that machine.
Right, and that's okay. So that's most people, you know. In the Windows XP EULA, there was a clause in the transfer rights section that said, and "I'm gonna quote it, but I'm gonna use the phrase Windows XP in lieu of the phrase the product, which is what it actually says." But so we understand what we're talking about, it says, "You may move Windows XP to a different workstation computer after the transfer. You must completely remove Windows XP from the former workstation computer." So
that's kind of the reasonable point of view that you're allowed to use one copy of this on any machine you own.
On a machine, exactly. And, you know, there's a lot of confusion here about does this grant implicitly an infinite number of transfers? You know, many people say yes because it doesn't explicitly say that you can't. And they probably have a point.
Although in practice, after one or two, you have to call Microsoft and get it authorized again.
Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting here, and this is the part I'd like to see challenged in court. Microsoft has the technology for you to do deauthorization, right? Why can't they deactivate a copy of Windows?
Many programs do that. Photoshop does that.
Sure. You can, you know, that way you as the owner of this piece of software, and you know, unfortunately you're not really the owner per se, but in this, you know, nirvana that my dream world is, you know, you could take this copy of Windows with you as you go. As it stands today, people do occasionally transfer a copy of Windows XP from one computer to another, and it works, apparently. This is something I've never done, but, you know, in my ivory tower computer reviewer world, I don't, you know, go to Best Buy and buy a copy of Windows XP, so maybe that's something I should try just to see what happens.
But yeah, let me tell you, the sticker shock will get you. I did it because I wanted to install it on a Mac, and it was $300 for the
XP Pro. Yeah, exactly. Who buys this thing, you know?
That was my question, is what is this doing sitting on the shelf? Afterwards told me you could get OEM versions cheaper and so forth. But
yeah, but that's, you know, that's tricky too, because technically when you buy an OEM version, it's a gray area certainly. I mean, you know, there are legal restrictions on how those versions of Windows can be sold, and technically speaking, when you buy that copy of an OEM version of Windows, you're supposed to get it with a piece of hardware, and that's the transfer rights go with that piece of hardware, which is weird because you probably got it with a USB cable or something.
Right. Yeah, so, Newegg and others are selling it that way. buy a floppy drive and get a copy of Windows.
Exactly. So, you know, I think once you do something like that, I think those people understand they're sort of working outside the box. You know, so I don't know that the licensing restrictions of Windows are going to bother them too much. Although, I suppose if they went to reactivate Windows and it didn't allow them to do so, you know, there would be some issues there. But the way it supposedly happens, and this is, you know, this is what Microsoft tells me, so I think we need to add the caveat that, you know, this is not a real world experience that I had, but supposedly when you go to reactivate a copy of Windows, it may reactivate electronically the first time, in which case you wouldn't have any issues at all. Mm-hmm. More frequently, however, you're probably going to get a phone-based activation. So Microsoft, the Windows will show a dialog box that has the number you need to call. It will be an 800 number, the equivalent in the country that you live in. You call the number, you explain to them that you upgraded the machine or that you transferred the copy of Windows, and they give you a code to type into the dialog, and then Windows is activated, and away you go. And, you know, back when XP first came out and Windows product activation became a known quantity, the big concern was that Microsoft was going to lock people out of their PC. And as it turns out, 5 years down the road, it really hasn't been an issue,
right?
You know, per se. Supposedly, and I have talked to a few people who have done this, the times when people have had to do phone-based activation, they actually haven't even asked for what the reason was. They've just allowed them
to just say, okay.
This is not a scientific answer. I'm sort of incidental based on some people I have talked to. So, flash forward to Windows Vista. They just released the new EULA for Windows Vista last week, and this is a big controversy, especially among people who are, you know, computer enthusiasts, the type of people who upgrade their hardware all the time, you know, gamers.
But people who listen to this podcast, frankly, I would say, or certainly a lot of the people who listen to my podcast are enthusiasts.
And as I discovered when I wrote about it and took Microsoft's side, people who read my website, too. That was a little embarrassing.
Enthusiasts tend to do that. You know, they buy a copy of Windows, they build a machine, and they build another machine, and they move the Windows over. Frankly, Microsoft probably knows, and I think most of us know, they may not take it off the old machine. They may just, you know, put it on several machines.
And with XP, you could kind of,
I know. With XP, you could kind of get away with that, as you say, that it didn't seem to check too carefully. I'm sure that's what they're addressing here, frankly.
Yeah, I think, you know, and this will be interesting to see how this changes, because I don't believe that Microsoft was actively comparing product keys on retail versions of XP, except for ones that were, you know, highly pirated.
Right. If they see 1,000 installs of something, they're kind
I don't believe that they have ever gone after anybody for having 5 copies on one.
That seems to be the anecdotal evidence. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the new EULA, the Windows Vista EULA, what it says is that, let me see if I can find this here. It says that you may now reassign the Windows Vista license, you know, the product license, to another device one time. So it explicitly says one time. Now, this is going to be an issue for people who have to reactivate, right?
Yeah, because, well, that's the question is...
Conceivably. Well, we don't know.
How now, smart are they going to be about it? If I'm reactivating because I put a new floppy drive and new network card into my system, that's so not here's a transfer. The thing. Are they going to know the difference?
Right. Well, I think that it's important to understand that there are differences between licensing rights and reality, which is, you know, you may have a license restriction that, you know, you can only do this thing one time, but it doesn't really affect anybody unless Microsoft actively enforces the license. So, according to Microsoft, what they're telling me is that the actual act of reactivating is unchanged in Windows Vista. So, if you have been using Windows XP all these years and you have upgraded your motherboard and your hard drive and your video card three times and whatever else you've done, and you go to do exactly the same thing with Windows Vista, in exactly the same time frame, you will have exactly the same experience regarding reactivating, or even a better experience, because actually Windows Vista is not as strict.
Oh, really?
With its reactivation requirements,
oh,
they tell
good.
Me.
All right.
Yeah, so there are two primary components of the PC that are affected by this. It's the motherboard and the hard drive. And while this isn't guaranteed, they said that basically their feeling was if you replaced the motherboard and the hard drive at the same time...
That's a new PC.
That's a new computer.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's their
fair.
Take.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, think most people think of the PC as the box.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, but I mean, a case is a case, but the motherboard's the brains and the guts and the hard drive.
Yeah, it's arguably the PC.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, so that's reasonable. So if you merely upgraded RAM or a new network card or a new hard drive controller, or even a new hard drive by itself, mm-hmm. Windows would not ask you for reactivation, or it would just automatically reactivate. It wouldn't
See,
ask
they won't
you.
Tell, they won't tell me.
We don't know.
Because there's an algorithm that determines whether or not that will occur. And I all they'll say is, if you replace the motherboard, it will be far more likely to require reactivation than if you replace any other component. You know, the next one down is the hard drive, and then there's a list of them after that. There are a bunch of... They're not going to give out the algorithm, obviously, but right. there are a bunch of things that they look at. And I suppose what this is aimed at is, you know, people who try to install the same copy of Windows on similar machines, or... You know, you can picture small businesses might buy the same Dell computer or something.
Right, right. Oh, interesting. Sure, that would look the same. But they must... That's what I always figured they were looking at. Things like the MAC address on your NIC, and there must be some sort of serial number identifier on the motherboard. I don't know about
Absolutely.
A hard drive, but yeah.
Yeah, the equivalent of a MAC address. Probably every hardware device has something like that, so...
Right.
I'm not a hardware expert, but yeah, I'm sure that that's what they're doing, so... You know, there are other parts to this EULA. I guess I would just point out, you know, the big new thing is they've addressed virtualization, right? You know, back when Windows XP came out 5 years ago, a lot of people were not using virtual machines, but now a lot of people are. So they're clearly spelling out, you know, what you can do with Windows Vista in a virtual machine. And to Microsoft, unless you're running the enterprise version, which has special licensing terms, an install of Windows Vista in a virtual machine is an install of Windows Vista, you know, as it would be on a PC.
Right.
And what that means is you can't use the same product key to install Windows Vista on your PC and in a virtual machine.
You know, Steve Gibson and I were talking about this, and I'm not sure his experience was exactly commensurate with mine. He was of the opinion that you could install it once. See, one of the things that's neat about VMware is the virtual machine that you create, you can move to any machine.
Yes.
And it's the same computer, essentially. He was of the opinion you'd install it once, you could make many copies, move it around, it'd all be the same copy of Windows. Do you get the impression that Microsoft will somehow know that you're doing that and prohibit it?
No. I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I think that, like I said, there's a difference between licensing and reality. So from a licensing standpoint,
you can't do it.
You can't do it.
But they're not...
You know, Microsoft is also... They've also restricted, for example, which versions of Windows Vista that you can install in a virtual machine. So they
there was some controversy over that, wasn't there? Because initially in the Windows blog, they said that you couldn't do it unless you had Ultimate Edition. And then that disappeared.
So I can tell you what they told me.
Because it sounds like they haven't decided, is what it sounds like to me. So what are they saying?
I think it was a little confusing to people. So what they basically what Microsoft does, they look at this and they think, well, who are the people that are going to be using Windows Vista in a virtual machine? We're talking about businesses primarily, people who do software testing and development, and enthusiasts. Okay, so the versions that they're allowing for license in a virtual machine are Business Edition and Ultimate Edition. Now, those two versions cover the business end and they cover the enthusiast end, right? Now, what about people? What if, you know, for some reason you may want to run Windows Vista Home Basic or Windows Vista Home Premium or whatever in a virtual machine?
Yeah. I might, on my Mac, I may not want Ultimate. I might just want to run Home because I need some basic Windows functionality.
And it's less expensive.
It's cheap. Yeah. And I don't need all those features.
Sure.
I guess one of the features I'm buying is the ability to use a virtual machine with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. There you go. That's one of the value pieces that you're getting. Some of the value you're getting. Well, their take on that is that if you're a developer and or a software developer and you actually need to test applications or web services, whatever it might be, on different Vista versions, you're probably going to have MSDN. MSDN users have different licensing terms. They can install whatever they want in a virtual machine. It's not a problem. You know, it's not going out in a real world.
I think it's kind of cuckoo because there's a big market. I think there's going to be a big market of Mac users, or actually Windows users who are switching to Mac, who want to run one program. A great example is the multiple listing service that realtors use. Only runs on Windows. Doesn't need a high end machine. Doesn't need anything fancy. They would be likely to buy a copy of Windows to run in Parallels or as a virtual machine on the Mac. And that's money in Microsoft's pocket. If Microsoft says you can't do that, are they going to buy the Ultimate Edition or are they going to just...
But you have to remember, when somebody goes into a retail store and they spend $199 or $299 or whatever it is, dollars, on this retail version of Windows, whatever, Microsoft has to support them. And... I think their take is that these things aren't selling for enough money for them to warrant the support costs of supporting people in virtual machines, especially if it's individuals, et cetera. So I'm sure there are good reasons. I mean, you know, again, we can debate the whys and wherefores and so forth, but I think that I think they should just allow any version to be in a VM personally, but that's not what they're doing. So if you have Enterprise Edition, which of course is the volume license version, completely different scenario. You can actually install that version of Vista in up to four other virtual machines. They can all be running simultaneously. They all have to be on the same hardware, but that's one of the benefits of the enterprise version. And again, that goes into support costs. I mean, Microsoft is getting a lot of money from these people, so it makes sense that they are providing them with the best.
How are they going to enforce this? Can they actually tell what you're doing?
No, and I asked him that. I said, I can install Windows Vista Home Basic in a VM right now.
Right.
Right? I mean, they can't stop you. I'm doing it as we speak.
I did.
But no, they can't stop you from doing it. That's the point.
The whole point of a virtual machine is it looks like a generic computer. It doesn't, it announces itself in some way that Microsoft could.
It can, but it won't. It doesn't. You know, I guess the point is just that, it will work. So if you want to do that as a Mac user, let's say.
I
would say Mac,
it's just not supported.
Mac users, it's not supported. So yourself or someone who uses a Mac and you're going to install Windows in a virtual machine, by definition, I think we're talking about a fairly technical person.
I disagree. I think that's the point. Okay. That's the point I'm making. And I think that's what Microsoft thinks as well, Paul. But I think that's the point I'm making is that there's this whole new market that they should embrace of people who are going to use a Mac and run Windows on it for one or two programs. And that's an opportunity to sell more units, in my opinion. Now, I understand they don't want to support it, so maybe that's the equation, and that makes sense.
I'm guessing that's the reason.
Don't say it's only enthusiasts that are going to want to do this, because I know there are a lot of normal people.
I would say enthusiasts. I would say a little on the more technical side. I mean, I think that, and again, you're right. It's probably changing, but
that's the point. It's changing. I don't know if it's changed, but it's changing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people who opt out of this sort of safety net of the Windows world, and if you go Linux or to a much greater degree, or Mac OS X, I mean, you're making a conscious decision here. I mean, you're gonna do something a little bit outside the mainstream, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with this, but you know, you've got a clearer idea of what's going on than the typical, yeah. I don't want to call them lemmings. I mean, but a Windows
user. No, you're
user,
probably
you know.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So those are the two big issues. I mean, there's some, I talked to Microsoft about some stuff that was a bigger issue back when product activation first came out with Windows XP, as far as the adding and removing of PC components. You know, they said it's like that old question. When does a boat become a new boat if you, you know, replace every plank in a boat? Is it the same boat or is this a new boat? You know, and that sort of issue has to do with, you know, upgrading and so forth. Now, when all this stuff happened, this was right after we recorded our last podcast. And so this would have been late last week, Thursday, Friday. And, you know, I woke up on Friday morning and I do my newsletter, and there was all this stuff out there. You know, all these people had opinions. And, you know, it's funny, you read licensing terms and you look at it and you say, well, you know, everyone has an opinion about it. But in the end, you know, we're not lawyers, you know. I mean, the Microsoft trial in the United States, when they had the big antitrust thing, introduced me to a whole new level of, you know, legal terms and crazy things that I would never normally write about. And and it's funny because on the flip side, I can read a financial magazine maybe, and they write about Microsoft, and I'm always intrigued by how they approach it because they come from a completely different standpoint than I do. So I saw all this stuff, you know, Friday morning that was written about this new EULA, and what amazed me was that the three big articles about it that were getting the most press all had contradictory information in them. You know, everybody read it and saw something a little bit different.
Right. That struck me as well. In fact, we had a hard time on Twitter really deciphering what was so.
Right. I mean, and again, and this just comes down to, you know, people who are, you know, enthusiasts or into computers are not necessarily lawyers. The people who write EULAs are lawyers and not necessarily into technology. You know, when the worlds clash, we get EULAs, you know, and it's kind of an ugly thing. So I called Microsoft on Friday and I said, look, I'd like to talk to somebody about this and straighten it out. And here are the questions I have, you know. So I spent a lot of time on the phone with those guys on Friday, and I wrote up an article about it that I published on Saturday. But before I did that, I wrote a blurb in Short Takes on Friday in the WinInfo newsletter, where I basically said my take on this is, my really quick take on this, is that I don't quite understand how many people this will really affect. I mean, sure, you know, computer enthusiasts who go nuts and, you know, change their computers regularly will be affected. But, you know, those guys are affected by this now with Windows XP. Right. I mean, I don't understand, you know, we can sort of pick nits about this or whatever. But, I mean, you know, whatever. I mean, I honestly didn't see what the big deal was. 100 emails later, I understood what the big deal was. But, you know, that took place over the weekend.
You got schooled.
Yeah, I really did. So, you know, I wrote up an article about the licensing changes where I basically just presented, you know, Microsoft's stance. And, you know, Microsoft presents this as a clarification, you know, that they don't really feel that it's changing dramatically, but rather that they're just clarifying something that was always there. And they're making things that were implicit more explicit, you know. And in Microsoft's world, or you know, in their opinion, the transfer rights thing, for example, was always aimed at specific circumstances. So if you had a hardware failure and you had to replace your motherboard, well, they were going to let you transfer that copy of Windows to the, you know, to what they would call the new machine. You know, whereas enthusiasts looked at this and said, well, wait a minute, it doesn't say I can only do this once, so I can do it more than once if it doesn't say that.
Right.
You know. So it was a big thing. So one thing I was able to do that was nice was I got a lot of email about this, and a lot of it wasn't very kind, you know. But
why were they yelling at you? It's not your fault.
I think there was a sense of betrayal, you know, to be honest. I mean, I wrote today in WinInfo, you know, it's like I was the mouth of Sauron or something. I mean,
well, talk about shoot the messenger.
It's, well, this is the irony of being me, right? I mean, not to get too deeply into the psychology of it, but, you know, my website is called Supersite for Windows, so by definition, I'm a Windows guy.
Right.
Probably a Windows sycophant.
And, so you should never say anything negative about anything Microsoft does.
Yeah, and anytime I say anything positive, of course,
it
this
goes
proves
the other
it.
Way
See,
as well.
You're in Bill Gates' back pocket.
Right. So you can't win either way, basically.
No.
And so, what I, so just ignore it, Paul.
I do. I mean, I've been doing this long enough where, it doesn't affect me.
You can't win. Yeah.
I tell my wife stories sometimes, and she looks at me and she says, I don't understand how you can tell.
Why did you choose this? Why did you choose this as a profession?
Yeah. I like to be criticized. So, on the flip side, I'll just say, too, I can be critical of Microsoft, and I've gotten some really amazing phone calls and emails from people at Microsoft that are there. PR department or once their legal department, where, you sort of forget sometimes there are human beings over there. And,
right. I err more on that side, I'll be honest with you.
You should, I wrote something highly critical of Media Center in Windows Vista, for example, last October, and I'll never forget this. I was on vacation in Montreal, actually, and I got a phone call from, someone at on the Media Center, and they were just, you really hurt
you
a lot
this?
Of feelings over here.
You broke our hearts.
And I just felt like such a jerk.
You were our guy, Paul.
Yeah, it was strange, but
People, but they also, just like you and me, we need to be honest with them. And when they do good things, I think it's fair to say, hey, it's not as bad as you think, guys. And when they do bad things, you need to say, hey, this isn't such a great thing.
Yeah, and that's the way I try to do it. But, I can be, I think as someone who's sort of passionate about technology, I think I went maybe in that case a little too far or and I do that sometimes. So I have these interesting, I have these interesting conversations. Yeah. As I say, for someone who communicates for a living, I do an awful job of communicating sometimes. So
so your essential take on this is this ain't so bad.
Well, I've come around a little bit because, I got a bunch of email over the weekend, and one of the guys that emailed me was this guy, Karosh Ghazi, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, but he runs a website called tweetguides.com. He was one of the 100 emails I got over the weekend.
That's a great site, by the way. I love that site.
It's a fantastic site. So he said, look, I appreciate what you're doing here. I like your writing, et cetera. I just can't agree with you on this thing, and here's why. And I wrote him back, and I said, I've gotten enough email about this that I want to do something to correct this. So I said, I don't know if you're interested in this, but how would you like to put, you can write an article, it could be whatever you want. I will edit it only for grammar and spelling. I'll put it up on my site. You can put any links to your site you want in there. I'll an ad, whatever.
Great.
Yeah, and I said, we'll just present the other side.
Yeah.
And if he didn't do that, if he wasn't interested, I was going to put something up on my site and ask people to, to write in.
Right.
But he agreed to do it, and I don't remember now if it was Sunday night or Monday morning or whenever. He came back with a fantastic article, actually. And, he kind of tore down a lot of the stuff I wrote and explained his point of view. And I have to say, I'm coming around, to that point of view. So he did a great job. It's up on the site. It's still linked to from the front page. So
He calls it the enthusiastic licensing restrictions.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, one thing I did, on this page is I got rid of I usually have ads in how I get paid. And I took the ads out and I put a link to his site instead because I don't want to, I'm not trying to make money off what he did.
Right.
And, it's just there.
That's
so
good of you. Yeah.
Both.
Now, have you
both,
come around a little bit having read what Karosh said?
Yes. And actually, it's funny because I wrote this in short takes, this wasn't the point of my, Supersite article about the licensing changes, but in short takes in my little throwaway Friday line, I sort of said, I don't understand what the big deal is. This is, a small percentage of people, and he said, okay, but let's look at the 5% figure that you're saying.
I agree with you more. He says that more and more people are tweaking their computers.
Yeah.
I disagree. I think the computer, the problem is somebody like Karosh, who works with enthusiasts, often get a kind of blind perception of what's going on in the community. It's like the blind man and the elephant. We're only seeing the trunk. And I'll tell you, when I do the radio show, which is much more a general audience, I mean, you're still a computer enthusiast if you're listening to a computer talk show, but they're much more of a general audience. They see it as a black box. I think that they don't tweak their computer to the degree that
I would just say this, though, is I'm not so much tweakers. I mean, I upgrade my computer regularly, actually. And I have to say, I've never seen a reactivation dialogue, at least outside of my
I don't think
WGA
most people
problems.
Upgrade. I don't think they add RAM. I don't think they add hard drives. I think they buy a box. They use it for 3 to 5 years. They throw it away.
I think you're right. But I two things I would just say to that. One is that remember that both Dell and HP have recently purchased high-end gaming PC companies, and they obviously see this as a market where they can make money and grow their own overall revenue. So,
well, yeah, because there's a lot of margin, It's a, right. It might be 1% of the audience, but there's 100% margin on those computers. So, of right. course, Dell
well,
wants
Microsoft
to be in that
used business. The percent, right? So they said 5% of people were actually screwing around with their computers. So, you know, what he said was, you know, let's say it is 5%. You know, Microsoft's own CEO said that the number of Windows PC users across the world would be over 1 billion by 2010. So if that's true,
that's a lot of people, right?
50 million people. Well, that's a lot. You know, that is a lot of people. More important, this crowd is the part of the Windows market. You know, the part of Microsoft's customer base. Let's say that is spending money in that ecosystem on a regular basis.
This is, I think, where Windows enthusiasts lose their way because, in fact, you got to understand Microsoft's mm-hmm. point of view on this. It's a commodity business. They don't care. They are cherry picking the 95%.
Yeah, no, you're right.
They don't have to appease 5%, even if it's 55 million people. That means there's almost a billion other people. You know, they're doing fine. I guess is my bottom line.
But you know, these most vocal people. These are the people who are going to listen to podcasts and help other people make decisions
right.
about what technology.
They're influencers. You're right. Yeah.
You know, again, I think it's pretty easy to stand by the comment that this is a small crowd based, you know, or compared to the overall Windows crowd. But, you know, there's a point to be made that Microsoft doesn't really get a lot out of screwing these guys out of, you know, they're not going to go buy another copy of Windows, I'm sorry. So, you know, if you're hurting them enough, they're going to bypass it with, you know, software hacks that are illegal, or they're going to, you know, run Linux or whatever. They might move to the Mac. Who knows? You know, Apple is a company that sells their operating system in a box that has no product key, no activation, nothing like that at all.
They can do that because they make the money on the hardware, right?
I'm not sure why they can do that.
Well, because they know that everybody who's running OS X bought a computer from Apple.
Sure, but in Apple's case, it's probably still true that most OS X, let's say most users of the most recent version of OS X acquired that operating system with a new computer,
right?
But they still sell millions of copies of this box software. So
yeah, they have a captive audience. They have an interesting audience.
Yeah, they sure do.
It's a different. It's a different crowd. And okay. I bought every update to OS X. And I will say, I have many Macs. I don't buy many copies of OS X. And even though Apple has very liberal multi-user license agreements, mm-hmm. Because there's no copy protection, and this is what Microsoft hates. There's no reason not to buy one copy of Tiger and put it on five machines.
And now the difference
is that Microsoft made no money on the hardware. They only make money on the software.
I don't understand. You know, Microsoft has figured this out in certain markets, but not others. For example, if you buy Windows Live OneCare, you can install that thing on, I think it's up to five computers, if I'm not mistaken.
It might be three.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's, anyway, it's more than one.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Why don't they offer a family pack for, you know, Vista Home Premium Home Basic, you know, Basic, where you can, for a couple $100,
that's what
you
Apple
get rights
does.
To. Right. Why not do that?
You'd certainly make a lot of friends, and you'd probably sell...
More copies of Windows, legitimate copies of Windows.
Let people be honest. People will be honest if you give them a way to do it easily and relatively inexpensively.
Exactly. Right. And unfortunately, in Microsoft's case, there's this presumption of guilt at the start. You know, our users are pirating our software.
Right.
You know, we're gonna increase the you know, the shackles every release. You know,
and this is my problem with all of this kind of protection is it teaches people to be criminals. It criminalizes. Because you believe they're criminals, you criminalize them. And if you're an enthusiast, if you're in this 5%, you have a lot of incentive to figure out ways around it.
Right. So if 1 year from now, there are a number of Windows users who have gone to Google and typed in something like, you know, how do I get Windows Vista installed on more than one computer? Microsoft's not doing what they should be doing.
Right. Well, look what happened with Windows Genuine Advantage. How many sites now have ways to disadvantage Genuine Advantage?
Exactly.
And now that's a little easier to do, frankly, than it will be, I imagine, to do this. But, you know, I don't know why Microsoft wants to put themselves in the business of kind of fighting with their users like that.
I know. I just don't get it. I really don't. I feel very, very, very strongly that this is the wrong way to treat people.
Right. I think that's where you and I and Koresh all are on the same page, which is whether it's good business for Microsoft or whether it's makes sense or whether you can justify it, it just doesn't seem like the right thing to do.
Right. I mean, you know, product activation, even in XP, I mean, who it's really hurting the most are individuals who, you know, like you said, maybe they have a second computer, it's running Windows 98. Well, maybe we'll put XP on here too. You know, if they can't get around that, they're not going to go buy another copy. They're just not going to use it.
Right.
You know, that's, you know, by offering some sort of a family pack or some way to buy, you know, it'd be like a, you know, an end user volume license almost, or whatever you want to call it. You know, Microsoft would actually make more money.
And make more friends. And,
exactly. They'd and look, God, could they use friends right now.
They'd look like a nicer company. You know? Yeah,
exactly.
They would look. You know, I mean, I like what Kurush wrote, but I have to say, in many respects, he's just dead wrong when he says, for instance, that games aren't doing this kind of protection. I don't know what games he's playing, but in fact, yeah. That's a huge problem right now in the gaming market. Almost all PC games are doing all sorts of nasty, draconian copy protection things, including not installing if you have any thing like alcohol 120% on your system, any piracy software in your system, so-called, they won't even install. So believe me, the gaming industry is doing a lot worse than Microsoft is in this regard.
Yeah, but not everyone buys games, but everyone has to run Windows, right? I think that's why it's a little more serious with Windows. But you know,
I understand why enthusiasts are upset. I really do. I mean,
absolutely.
I'm not.
I like when you install. I think it's id Software. You know. Their various games, Doom 3, Quake 4, whatever, you install one of those games and you have to type in a product key. And when it accepts it, it doesn't say your product key is valid. It says, it appears that your product key is valid.
We might trust you for the moment. Don't you get your hopes up, though.
Jeez.
We reserve at any time the right to boot you off our network.
Yeah. Talk about the presumption
it
of guilt.
Appears. I know, that's really, really sad. So when you talked to Microsoft, you felt like they made a good case for what they were doing. Did you get the sense that they also, and this is where there was some debate, it seemed to many bloggers and so forth that Microsoft really wasn't sure what they were going to do yet. Did you get the sense that they've already decided this is written in stone?
Oh, no, this is in the can.
There's nothing we can do about it now.
Yeah, there's nothing like that.
No point in protesting. They have decided this is what it's going to be.
I think I guess when you're trying to drive readers to your site and so forth, there are many people who, you know, they want to be controversial, whatever it is, but people would point out that, you know, hey, Microsoft highlighted the fact that they came up with this new EULA on one of their blogs, but they didn't point anyone to these major changes, you know,
right.
Whereas, you know, the guys that did that, I mean, just not that I know them personally necessarily, but most likely didn't find that very controversial. Maybe didn't even know that was part of the deal. I mean, you know, I think people...
Well, they learned.
they learned.
That's one of the things you learn in this business nowadays, in the words of Doc Searles and the Clue Train guys, markets are a conversation, and you're no longer a company just laying it down and letting them pick it up. You're going to hear from everybody. And that's great
for
consumers, as long as the companies listen. One more piece of news before we run, and that's XP Service Pack 3, which has been in the works for a while, but I guess Vista probably slowed it down a little bit. They do have plans for it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this has been on the slow train forever.
Really, but, slow train.
Yeah, and I don't quite understand this, because Windows XP Service Pack 3 is no new features, right? This is just a collection of already released hot fixes.
It's just a roll-up. So it's not like SP2 was, where we really are changing things.
This is something, they should be able to release one of these every 6 months. I don't understand what the problem is. So they've delayed it until the first half of 2008, which is a nice way of saying we're never releasing it. So we're hoping, you
Wait
know,
a minute.
Everyone's
not
running
next
Vista
year,
by then.
2 years from now. Almost.
Yeah.
Wow.
2 years. I mean, that's astonishing.
Do you think they're really saying, that's what they're saying is, look, we're moving everybody to Vista. Don't stay with XP. I mean, that must be the message they want to give business right now.
This is exactly what they did with Windows 2000. You know, before XP happened, oh, no, don't worry, we're going to support Windows 2000. You know, it's gone.
Right.
You know,
just before Apple released the Macintosh, they had a convention called Apple II Forever.
Oh, God.
as I remember, I may be wrong here, but I don't think the Apple II did, in fact, last forever.
No, but you know, if Apple had made the PC, you know, PCs today would be Apple IIs with a GUI on top.
Yeah, you're probably right. You know,
that's what the PC is, basically. Right?
Yeah, they have a GUI, and but underneath, there's still something. There's still something. So, Paul, always a pleasure. I look forward to talking to you next week, and I'm sure Microsoft will give us some wonderful controversy for you to play with. If people want to read Paul's original article on licensing, and then Koresh's response, Windows Vista enthusiastic licensing restrictions, it's all on the Win Super site. Paul Thurrott's super site for Windows, winsupersite.com. And a must read, really. And, you know, in a way, I love the dialogue and the controversy. I think it's great that your readers are so involved and they talk back, and that you let them then, you know, you put it up there. And I think that's really...
That was a neat thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really great. That's nice. That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about.
Yeah, I agree.
And just a little Mac news, on your Internet Nexus, you said that Apple said that Leopard will ship after Vista comes out.
Yeah, they didn't say it that way, but I think that's what they were trying to say. I mean, I don't think Windows Vista is going to be delayed past January, so
It would have been a mistake to say anything like that a few months ago. But I think now we know Vista will be out.
And I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, so what? You know,
right.
I mean, if Leopard comes out 3 months after Vista, it's not going to affect sales of either operating system.
No, I don't think so. It's completely different markets. Yeah, Paul Thurrott, we'll talk again next week. And
yes,
thank you for joining us. WinSupersite.com, and Paul's blog is internet-nexus.com. I'm Leo Laporte. Make sure you check out, if you like this show, you might want to check out Security Now, Steve Gibson's security podcast. We cover a lot of Windows security topics. And, of course, This Week in Tech every Sunday. Dvorak and Patrick Norton and I and a host of fascinating regulars, Jerry Parnell last week, whether that was a treat, talk about the week's tech news. All of it available at twit.tv, and the servers are up, everything's up, everything's normal, everything's running. I'm getting email now. Jeez, it was a bad week for me, Paul. Oh man. And I was in Linux hell, so there you go. twit.tv. We'll see you next time on Windows Weekly.